Coleman Hawkins opening up this afternoon's Fresh Air with a recording of Bouncing with Bean. WUHY has been broadcasting live coverage of the UN Security Council meetings on Iran. The Security Council reconvenes this afternoon at 4 o'clock. At that time, we will rejoin National Public Radio for live coverage from the UN. This will preempt this week's edition of Alec Wilder and the American Popular Song. We'll pick up the series again next Monday at 4 o'clock. Fresh Air's arts reviewer Judy Stein will be with us at 3:30 today. She joins us every Monday at 3:30 to review museum and gallery shows in the Delaware Valley. At 3, we'll be joined by Steve Kahn, who's, among other things, an expert on teen marketing. He produced the Miss American Teenager pageant for ABC Television. He created the comic spin-offs of The $6 Million Man and The Bionic Woman, and he served as the youth marketing consultant for various corporations. His latest venture is a novel, a thriller, that he's written called New York, New York 10022. That's a zip code. It's about a mail heist in Manhattan, published no doubt to coincide with the Christmas mail rush. When he joins us, we'll talk about how he follows or creates teen trends, and we'll also discuss the subject of his book. Last Tuesday, the ACLU filed suit to stop the order from the U.S. Department of Justice ordering all Iranians holding student visas to report to the Immigration and Naturalization Service for a review on their status. The ACLU is opposing this order on the grounds that it represents discriminatory treatment of a group based on their nationality. The government has agreed not to deport any students before the hearing, which is scheduled for tomorrow. With me to discuss this and other issues is the executive director of the ACLU, Ira Glasser. He's the fifth director of the ACLU, which is now 59 years old. They'll be celebrating their 60th birthday in January. Before becoming executive director of the national ACLU, Ira Glasser served as executive director of the New York branch of the ACLU. He's in Philadelphia to speak this evening at the annual meeting of the Greater Philadelphia branch of the ACLU. The meeting will be held at the Ethical Society, which is at 1906 South Rittenhouse Square. It will begin at 7:30, and the meeting is open to the public. Again, it will be at the Ethical Society, 1906 South Rittenhouse Square, at 7:30. Ira Glasser, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Before we discuss some of the broad issues that the ACLU deals with, let's talk specifically about the suit which was filed last week, which comes to the courts tomorrow. Who exactly are you suing in the Iranian student case?
Well, we're basically suing the government, the Immigration Service, and the president against what we see as a discrimination based on nationality, unrelated to any legitimate need that the government has. We are not opposing the government's authority to do what it normally does with student visitors, which is to periodically check up on their status to see if they're here legally or not. Nor are we quarreling with their authority to deport people if they are found to be here illegally. What we are quarreling with is the fact that they have singled out Iranians and only Iranians, I think as a reprisal for what is going on in Iran, when there is no reason to believe that there are more illegal aliens among the Iranians than there are among other national groups, when there is no reason to believe that the Iranians here represent any danger, when there's no evidence that anybody here is a terrorist or anything else, when among the Iranian students who are here are included Iranian Jews, for example, and Iranian Christians, who some of whom, many of whom, fear for their lives if they are sent back. There are people here, Iranians, who have spoken out against the Ayatollah and who fear for their lives if they are sent back. Many of the Iranians, most of them, are not political at all, but are here for an education. And all of those kinds of people are being swept into this indiscriminate net. The essence of prejudice is when you attribute to individuals the characteristics of a class, to say that all blacks are such and such or all women are such and such. What the government has done here is to say that all Iranians are dangerous because of what the Iranian government is doing in Iran. And that is what we are opposing.
I'm sure some people are thinking, well, Sure, it's a bad action to take, but these are extenuating circumstances. Iran has all these Americans that they're holding hostage, and they're refusing to cooperate with us. Say that there's some students here who are in collusion with the Iranian students there. Isn't it worth it to just this once ask all the Iranian students to report so that, you know, we might be able to protect someone here through doing that? We might be able to send back Iranian students who are plotting something terrible in this country.
Well, there's two things to be said about that. First of all, that was much the argument that was used in the early 1940s against people of Japanese ancestry here in America. For those listeners who are too young to remember, we actually put into camps for the duration of the war virtually the entire Japanese-American population, and these were citizens besides most of them, during World War II, following the attack on Pearl Harbor. At that time, I can well imagine that a lot of people, that was a much worse circumstance than this, a lot of people sat around and said, well, it's a terrible thing to put people into these camps as a result of their ancestry. But after all, we were attacked by Japan. We don't know which of them are sympathetic. We're in the middle of a war. I mean, all of those circumstances were far worse than what we have now. And it was possible for even people who normally would shudder at the thought of discriminating on the basis of nationality or ancestry to have most of those people justified what we did then. Well, now everybody's ashamed of it. Now everybody recognized that it bore no relationship to protecting ourselves then. And in fact, there are bills pending in Congress right at this moment to provide redress to the families and descendants of those people whose lives we ruined back then out of just this kind of an impulse. While those laws are pending to provide redress for something which embarrasses us now, 25, 30 years later, we're engaging in the same kind of a thing. It's always hard to be moral at the time when it counts. It's always easy to be moral 20 years later. The other thing to be said is that there is no evidence that the government is even finding out or investigating the fact of whether or not particular Iranians here represent some danger to us. It's important to understand that when you talk about illegal student aliens, you're not talking about people who have, you know, arrived here by swimming in the middle of the night and mean to do us harm. Illegal aliens for students tends to mean things like, in order to maintain their status, they have to take a full credit of 12. If you drop a course for a semester because you're failing, as many students do, and you decide to take it the next term, you are technically out of compliance with your visa. If you don't have any money for the moment and you drop out of school to take a job, being here to work is not a permissible reason when you've been granted visitor status in order to go to school. If you notify anybody about that, you can be deported. So a lot of students who are here will drop in and out of school, will take a job, will come back. That's especially true since we've frozen a lot of Iranian assets that a lot of the government aid that Iranians are getting, they no longer get. So that the if they switch schools without notifying, a lot of what is called illegal aliens are those kinds of technical violations. They don't represent any danger or any criminal activity. Normally, the government doesn't spend a lot of time enforcing that, and it is not enforcing it against any other students. So the whole thing smacks not of any legitimate need to respond to something which puts anyone in danger or will in any way affect the terrible situation in Iran. It's really a public kind of reprisal to sort of let Americans who are justifiably angry about what's happening in Iran, that look, we're doing something tough. It's a kind of a street response. You know, you hit one of mine, I'll hit one of yours. But it's something I think which we ought not to engage in. I think at bottom what most Americans object to about what's happening in Iran is that innocent people, the hostages, are being punished on the basis of their nationality, namely that they are Americans, because of a dispute between their governments. It doesn't serve us well for us to do the same thing here.
What do you expect to happen tomorrow when the suit does get taken to court?
Well, that's hard to say. The case is not an easy case. What may be a strong moral principle doesn't mean that it's necessarily a strong legal principle. And the Immigration Service has a long tradition of having a lot of discretion to do what it wants. The question of whether and to what degree the Constitution limits the power of the Immigration Service to engage in this kind of discretion is a highly technical and complicated legal question, and it's not easy to say what the result will be.
Was it ever a question whether or not you should take on this case, or did it become obvious
Oh, no.
To
no,
the ACLU as soon as the Immigration Service issued this order that it was a case that had to be taken
now,
on.
Now, these things, despite the fact the speed with which we seem to respond to some of these things, they're never obvious, and they are never taken reflexively or without a lot of internal debate, which is rarely unanimous, I might say. We issued our statement and filed our lawsuit a good week after this action was announced by the government. We debated it a good deal. We in fact, fortuitously happened to have a national executive committee meeting just about that time that was happening. And the entire issue was debated at the executive committee. Not everybody agreed. Some people who agreed didn't agree right away, but agreed after we discussed it. It was that meeting which authorized the lawsuit, and so, in fact, a lot of debate did take place, and it is not an easy issue. The fact that once we decide to do something and have thought it through and done the research and looked at the law and examined some historical precedents, you know, the fact that we have a clear conclusion doesn't mean that that conclusion was so easy to arrive at or that we did so quickly.
How would you define the goals of the ACLU?
Well, the ACLU, very simply, exists as the only private organization in America which is outside the government and designed to try to help enforce the Bill of Rights, which is a legal document that imposes certain kinds of limits on what the government can do. A right, I think, can be defined as a limit on government power. If you have the right freedom of press, if you have the right to sit here and say what you want over the airwaves, that means the government doesn't have the power to censor you. If the government does have the power to censor you, you don't have the right. If you have the right to go to whatever church you want and worship the way you please, that means the government doesn't have the power to stop you. If you have the right to a secret ballot, it means the government doesn't have the power to look. Every individual right can be defined as a limitation on government power. The Bill of Rights is really a list of government limits that establishes individual rights, and the ACLU exists for no other purpose but to enforce those limits, regardless of who the individuals are or what they believe or whether their race, their sex, their political belief, or their religious belief. That's the reason why we frequently, in defense of these principles, end up defending people the content of whose views we don't necessarily agree with.
Does a case have to have a certain magnitude for you to take it on? Does it have to be a really horrible infringement of the Bill of Rights before the ACLU will step in?
Well, generally, yes. We try to stay away from trivial or frivolous cases for a simple reason that there are plenty of important cases to take, and we have limited resources. The ACLU handles 6,000 cases a year now, which is a staggering amount. Makes us, I guess, the biggest private law firm in America. But most of those cases are handled by volunteers. A lot of them are very expensive. In a lot of places in this country, the ACLU doesn't have any staff at all and is entirely a volunteer operation in terms of its legal cases. And we therefore have to pick and choose pretty carefully on the basis of what cases are going to do the most good. As a result, we tend to take those cases which we think will affect the most people or will establish a legal principle which protects a lot of people and not only the people in whose behalf we are bringing the case.
You're referring to the idea of precedent that, for instance, in the Iranian situation, if you won this suit, that means that tomorrow, if there was an order issued for all German students to report to the Immigration Service, that could be squashed right away because the day before that principle was proven to be illegal.
Well, that's right, and that's not fanciful. For example, it's entirely possible that an Irish group, because of the kind of turmoil that's going on in Northern Ireland, could take over an embassy or hold Americans hostage in Ireland, or that an Arab group or an Israeli group in the Middle East could do the same thing there. It would be unthinkable, I think, at that point, to then engage in those kinds of reprisals against Irish people here or against Jews or against Arabs. The single lesson one comes away with the most after looking at history is that the individual victims of a particular government abuse are not so important as establishing the principle that the government can't do that, because as sure as we are sitting here, if they can do it to one, they will do it to others. And we are all, in that sense, potential victims. That's not an abstract principle that was dreamt up in an ivory tower by law professors. That's a hard fact of political life, and it's something that the people who founded this country recognized. I mean, they were not themselves ivory tower people. They were hard-nosed politicians. When you're talking about Thomas Jefferson and James Madison and Alexander Hamilton and John Jay and those people who were responsible for putting together the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, these were people who recognized that if you don't establish sharp limits on government power, we are all potential victims, and sooner or later, we all will be.
So you go to the court, you set a precedent. How lasting is that precedent? Can't someone overturn it the next day or the next year?
Well,
next
there's two things to be said about that. One is that if you establish a principle through a court decision, it is not self-enforcing. The fact that the Supreme Court says that the government doesn't have the power to do something doesn't mean that government officials everywhere are going to obey that order. When the Supreme Court said in 1954 that school desegregation was illegal, it didn't mean that the schools got desegregated the next morning. In fact, it took 25 years, and we're still not through. The difficulty of enforcing court decisions means that the precedent is really a paper precedent, unless you're out there every day enforcing it against local officials where you live. That's why the ACLU was organized, not by having a big headquarters in New York and Washington alone, but that the basic guts of the ACLU organization is to have a branch in every city and in every state, because the only way to enforce precedents declared by the Supreme Court is to enforce them locally. The second part of that is that a precedent lasts only so long as the Supreme Court continues to agree with it. If you get different people on the Supreme Court, they can and have overturned decisions made by the prior court. Now, that doesn't happen in any facile way. It doesn't just, you know, turn everything over black and white. But there have been more than a few instances where the results established by one court have been drastically modified by another court, sometimes in a good direction and sometimes in a bad direction. The case itself saying that school desegregation was illegal and unconstitutional in 1954 overturned a precedent of a previous decision by a previous court that had approved school desegregation. Many of the decisions today by a court that is dominated by people who were appointed by Richard Nixon are eroding a lot of the constitutional principles that were established by the Warren Court 15 or 20 years ago.
As you pointed out before, sometimes to defend an important freedom, you'll go to court on the behalf of a group who you might strongly disagree with politically. You might have strong disagreements with the content of what they have to say, but want to support their right to say it. And the most obvious example of that is the times that the ACLU has gone to court to defend the right of the Nazis to march or to hold rallies or address people in public. And that had a very bad effect on the ACLU in terms of a lot of the supporters saying, well, if you're going to support them, I ain't going to support you. Are you still trying to get back on your feet from that?
Well, I think we pretty much have gotten back on our feet from that. We are not out of the woods financially, but every public interest organization is facing difficult times because of inflation and other things like that. To the extent that we suffered because of Skokie, I think that we have more than made up for it. Jules Pfeiffer said a year or so ago that why is it that the ACLU defends people who you wouldn't like to have over for dinner? And in strongly supporting the fact that we do, he noted a very important point that we don't defend people because we like them. In many cases, our clients are the last people we would want to have over for dinner. But the fact is that if the town of Skokie, for example, could have been allowed to pass an ordinance saying that nobody can demonstrate in that town unless they get a $300,000 insurance bond, which is the way the law was phrased. That law did not say Nazis couldn't demonstrate. It said that nobody can demonstrate unless they had a $300,000 insurance bond. Now, the fact is nobody can get a $300,000 insurance bond, not because it's too expensive, but because insurance companies won't issue such a bond, which essentially would insure people against violence erupting and things like that. At the same time that we were trying to strike down that law in Skokie, the town of Chicago had passed the same ordinance and was using it to stop the Martin Luther King Jr. Association, a black civil rights organization, from having demonstrations in Marquette Park on the southwest side of Chicago. Now, that one didn't get a lot of publicity. But the fact of the matter is that there we were at the same time in two different Illinois courts defending the same principle. There was literally no way to defend one without defending the other, unless you were willing to say that the rights that exist for the Martin Luther King Jr. Association shouldn't exist for the Nazis. If you were willing to say that, you had a better hope that a court agreed with you, and you had to rely on the fact that who gets to demonstrate and who gets to have rights depends on the approval of a government agency, whether it's a court or a town council or something else. It is precisely to avoid that kind of discretion that the Bill of Rights was invented, because if you allow a town council to decide who gets to speak, it's not going to mostly be the folks we like. As a matter of fact, a lot of the precedents that were established in the South during the civil rights struggle, which allowed Martin Luther King and other civil rights activists to demonstrate there, were the ones that were used to allow the Nazis to demonstrate in Skokie. And if you grant the town council in Skokie the power to decide who should speak, you have to also be prepared to grant the town council in Little Rock and in Jackson and in most of those southern towns. There is no practical way to distinguish between those.
What some people who were against the ACLU stand were saying is that this isn't just a question of having people speak, it's a question of having them say very hateful things, things that really might incite violence to residents of this neighborhood.
Well, of course, that's what governments always say. That's what Nixon and John Mitchell said when they arrested all the May Day demonstrators. They said that what we were doing this for was to prevent them from closing down Washington. That's what all the town councils in the South said when they turned the fire hoses and the police dogs and the cattle prods on the civil rights workers. In fact, it was to prevent violence that most of the violence occurred in the South. I mean, that's why the Freedom Riders were beaten up, because see, what happens then is you get what the Supreme Court has called a heckler's veto. If other people are going to threaten violence, that means you don't get to speak. What the Constitution says is that the role of the police is to protect you against the violence, not to abridge your freedom to speak because it's afraid of violence. And in fact, violence almost never occurs in those situations and did not occur in Skokie. And if there is violence, as there was with the Klan a few months ago in the South, the role of the police has to be to make sure that the people who are peacefully exercising their right to free speech are protected.
You've worked with the ACLU for a number of years. You were the executive director of the New York branch of the ACLU since 1970, and I guess about a year and a half ago, you took on the position of executive director of the national ACLU. Have your feelings about the American legal system changed? Have you become any more confident or unconfident with it?
Well, I grew up in New York as a liberal, in a liberal house where I didn't know anybody who didn't vote for Adlai Stevenson in 1952 and 56, and a kind of a typical New York Democratic liberal household. And I grew up breathing and eating the New Deal, and that meant that one grew up having great faith in government power and in the wisdom of government power and in the capacity of government power to make things better. I guess I'm a little more distrustful of that after 10 or 12 years at the ACLU than I was. I suppose in some sense you might say that makes one a little more conservative, because it is supposed to be the conservatives who are sufficiently afraid of government power to want to limit it all the time. It's supposed to be the liberals who have increasing faith in government power. The fact is that government power is a two-edged sword. It has enormous power to do good, and it also has enormous power when you get abuses of that power to violate people's rights by exceeding the limits established by the Bill of Rights. You got to be very careful when the government has as much power as it does today to make sure that those limits are enforced. I guess I am much more impressed than I would have been had I not worked for the Civil Liberties Union this past decade with the need to make sure that those limits are enforced. And I guess I now believe, as I once did not, that even good people who intend to do nothing but good and intend to help people, when they get a lot of power, can be dangerous. Thomas Jefferson tried to censor speech at the University of Virginia. He enforced the Alien and Sedition Acts. He engaged in border searches. He was a much better civil libertarian when he before he was president and after he was president than during the time he was president. Franklin Roosevelt established the executive order, which was used by John Mitchell years later as the authority for warrantless wiretapping. Abraham Lincoln suspended the right of habeas corpus. It was under Roosevelt's administration that the Japanese were interred. It doesn't matter if you're liberal or conservative. When you have power and the need seems compelling, you exercise it and never mind the limits. That's why it's important, whether you're conservative or liberal, to have something that imposes an external restraint. And I guess I understand that a lot more, having worked for the ACLU, than I would have before.
I don't really want to ask you to pass judgment on your colleagues, but a similar situation applies with lawyers. People emerge from law school and after a few years have a certain amount of power, and that power either comes from their stance within the courtroom or just from the power that money provides. And if you have a lucrative profession, you have power through money. Have you seen a lot of lawyers really have their politics completely changed through experience?
It depends on which lawyers you're talking about. I mean, I think that that's right. Lawyers in private practice are no different than anybody else. They're basically businessmen and women, and they're not particularly liberal or particularly respectful of rights. I think that among our members, for example, very small numbers of our members are lawyers. The largest profession among the ACLU members is probably teachers. I don't think being a lawyer necessarily means anything. It certainly didn't help the folks in Watergate to respect the law. I mean, it's just like any other profession. I don't think that there's any reason to believe that lawyers more than anyone else are likely to carry certain values. There were a number of lawyers, of course, who left private practice to spend a little time working in the civil rights movement or the civil liberties movement, 10, 15, 20 years ago, and never went back. That was during the middle 60s and late 60s. I've seen a great many of those people changed very dramatically by their exposure to problems they didn't know existed before. I should point out that most people in the ACLU, not only members, are not lawyers. I am not a lawyer, which surprises some people. And I sometimes say that I represent civilian control over the lawyers. And most executive directors of the ACLU, both nationally and locally, are not lawyers, because enforcing the Bill of Rights is not a technical question. It's a question of values and a question of that everybody needs to be interested in. The reason why the ACLU uses lawyers so much and depends on lawyers so much is that the Bill of Rights is a legal document, and enforcing it frequently means you got to go into court. So law and lawyers become an instrument with which we protect the Bill of Rights, a weapon, if you will. But it's a mistake to think that that the process of going to law school or becoming a lawyer itself is productive of the kinds of values that lead one to support the Bill of Rights.
Law in this country is a very political thing in some respects. For instance, the Supreme Court justices are political appointees. How does that affect to you the ability of law to really do its job in this country and to maintain a certain separation from the political system?
Well, it is separated to some degree. It's as separated as any other, more so than any other political institution. The theory is this. Legislatures are elected. Executives, president, the governor, the mayor, are elected. That means that legislators and executive officials are responsive and must be responsive to the majority. But the Bill of Rights is intended to protect minorities against the majority. And the Bill of Rights is intended to say that just because whites are in the majority, they can't abuse blacks or deny them their rights. Just because men are in the majority, they can't deny women their rights. That just because adults are in the majority, they can't deny children their rights. That just because Democrats may be in the majority, they can't take away rights from Republicans, or that Democrats and Republicans together cannot take away rights from other political parties. That just because Protestants are in the majority, they can't take away the religious rights of Catholics or Jews or Muslims or anybody else. The Bill of Rights is designed to limit the majority and to protect minorities. As such, the Bill of Rights cannot depend too much on the legislature or on executive officials, who have to, in order to get elected, be responsive to the majority that the Bill of Rights is intended to limit. The courts, the federal courts, were established to deal with that. They are the instrument of government that needs to be responsive to minorities and needs to be insulated from majority political power. The way to do that is that's why you have lifetime appointments. Once they are appointed, they cannot be removed, no matter how unpopular their decisions, because without that, they would not be able to make those kinds of unpopular decisions. They can be removed by impeachment, of course, if they're grossly incompetent, or if they're crazy, or if they're alcoholic, or if they engage in what the Constitution calls high crimes and misdemeanors. But by and large, that has not occurred very often, and that's the way that judges are insulated. And therefore, the federal judiciary is insulated from politics more than any other institution. It is not insulated, of course, at the point at which judges are appointed. Since they are appointed by the president with the consent of the Senate, and usually with the explicit agreement of the two senators in the state from which the judge is appointed, all of that is worked out in a very political fashion. And as a consequence, sometimes judges are not responsive to the minorities at all. There's a judge in Mississippi named Harold Cox, who is a flat-out racist, always has been, was appointed during that time where federal judgeships were political payoffs. All of the politicians in the Democratic Party at that time were part of a white discriminatory majority, and it didn't matter whether or not I think the president who appointed Harold Cox was John F. Kennedy. The way the appointments took place, the values of the particular president didn't even necessarily matter. On the other hand, things happen that you can't predict. I don't know that Dwight Eisenhower, who appointed Earl Warren, had any way of knowing that Warren would lead the court into the kind of libertarian decade that his administration meant. I don't know that anyone could have predicted that. Nixon, of course, knew exactly what he was doing. He meant to dismantle the Warren Court, and did. If Nixon's song has ended, it's certainly fair to say that his melody lingers on, and the place where it lingers on is in the Supreme Court, where four of the nine people were appointed by him, and together with a couple of conservatives that were left over from previous presidential appointments, they have formed a strong Nixon majority on the court, which will last for the rest of our professional lives, and which has already eroded many of the decisions that the Warren Court made. In that way, the court is much more political than people tend to think and is not as insulated as lawyers sometimes tend to think. But once the appointment takes place, judges are as insulated as it is possible to be from the political impacts of their decisions. And that is absolutely crucial if the decisions are to be responsive to the rights of minorities.
Do you wish that the method of appointing Supreme Court judges was reformed?
No. Because I can't really imagine a way of doing it. That would avoid the problem. It is better that the politics be explicit and out front where we can all see it. The fact is, more Americans pay attention to that appointment process now than they used to. And that is why when Harold Carswell was nominated some years ago, he did not get appointed because there was a great hue and a cry. When Harold Cox was appointed, hardly anybody noticed. The remedy, if there is a remedy, is to subject that to the public glare. No one ought to have the illusion that it is possible through reforms to get rid of politics or to get rid of subjectivity.
Even on the local level, the judges that you do have the opportunity to vote for, how many people really know the names of any of the judges on the ballot or know more than just their names? It's an office that there's very little information about the people who are running.
Well, there always is. It tends to be of less interest to people than the major things like senator and governor and, you know, congressional representative and so forth. But the other thing is that I don't know that you want to expose judges to election, which is an even more direct representation of majority will. I mean, I would not have wanted the whites in the South to be electing judges when the judges had to rule on issues raised by blacks as to whether or not the whites were oppressive. When one of the issues, for example, was whether or not blacks have the right to vote, you wouldn't want that issue decided by judges who, in effect, were elected by whites. So I think that the appointment process for the federal judiciary is probably the best that can be devised. And by and large, the federal judiciary has been more responsive to the rights and interests of minorities of all kinds in this country, racial, religious, sexual, political, than any other institution.
You're pointing out, I think, a really irreconcilable conflict, and that is the fairness of the choice of people who you have trust in, as opposed to a majority rule. We have a lot of faith in majority rule, and we use it for elections, but the majority of people aren't necessarily very fair-minded.
Well, every school child learns that the American system is built on the notion of majority rule. What every school child doesn't learn, that there really are two basic principles of the American system. One is majority rule, and the other are limits on majority rule. And now those limits are what define individual rights, as I mentioned before, and those limits are basically contained in the Bill of Rights. They're a list of limits. They say what government cannot do. They say what the majority cannot do. Now, that's a great experiment. There's no other country has ever tried, before we did in the 18th century, to establish a written set of limits on government and to limit majority rule in that way. One of the reasons why America is such a unique experiment in human rights is that for all of its imperfections and for all of the ways in which the written Bill of Rights is not as fully enforced or as fully realized as some of us would like, America is the only country which for 200 years has made a real rigorous attempt to establish as part of the written law with an agency of government, namely the courts, to enforce it, to establish strict limits of power against the majority in order to guarantee the rights of the minority, of various minorities. And it's a great experiment, and by and large, most days I'm optimistic about its success.
Would you be able to give us a sense of some of the strides you think we've made in terms of civil rights during this decade that's about to come to the end, and some of the rights that you think have been lost in precedents that have been set?
Well, let me take even a little bit longer perspective than that. It is fashionable these days among civil rights and civil liberties professionals to sort of feel a little despair at this point. By and large, because such tremendous gains were made in the middle 60s and late 60s and early 70s, and the Warren Court was such a great time to be alive if you were a civil liberties lawyer. You basically knew that whatever happened in the lower courts when you got to the Supreme Court, you were going to win. Now you basically know the opposite. Whatever happens in the lower courts, you figure you're going to lose when you get to the Supreme Court. And so it's sort of been fashionable to be a little discouraged now about progress. Roger Baldwin, who founded the ACLU with a few of his friends in 1920 and who's still alive and about to be 96 years old, often likes to say what an optimist he is because he has a longer view than the rest of us. I often think that the reason why we all learn plane geometry in school is that the Greeks all couldn't see very far, and it's why they thought the earth was flat, and you get all these flat figures that don't exist in real life. When you can't see very far, you make mistakes, and that's why people thought the earth was flat. Well, that's why we're discouraged, because we're operating out of the period of the last 10 or 12 or 15 years, and we have followed a period of tremendous progress in civil rights and civil liberties by a time where that progress is flattening off and even declining. So you tend, in the short view, to be discouraged. But Roger, as I said, has a longer view, and he looks back upon a time when the ACLU started in 1920 and in its early years, in 1930s and 40s. When the ACLU started, racism was legal. Discrimination and segregation were legal, and there was no hope by anybody who lived at that time that they would, in their lifetime, see an end to that. People were lynched because of their race every day back then. That was true up until very recently as well. People didn't have the right to strike. There were no rights of labor. When people tried to strike and to form a union, they were beaten up by hired thugs, and the government didn't do anything about it. All the protective labor legislation, the minimum wages, Fair Labor Standards Act, the right to collectively organize, the right to bargain, none of that existed. There was violence in the streets because people wanted rights in the context of their work. Women didn't have any rights, and it was unthinkable to think that they should or that they would. The major issue of the day, the only feminist issue of the day, was the right to vote. And it was in 1920, the year that the ACLU was organized, that the Constitution Amendment was ratified, giving women the rights to vote. That was as far as anyone thought it was possible to go back then. Groups like prisoners, mental patients, children, people in school, American Indians, groups that in whose behalf tremendous gains have been made in the last decade. It was literally unthinkable to suppose that they had any rights. I mean, when I say literally unthinkable, I mean it couldn't have occurred to anybody. When you put all that together, there's been a tremendous amount of progress, and that progress is not going to be rolled back by a particular conservative court. It may be stopped, it may be flattened out, it may be eroded in this or that particular, but there's no way back to that time again. And so people who have a little bit of a longer view are quite optimistic that the tide of advancement in the cause of individual liberty is with us, and that the Bill of Rights is a lot closer to being fulfilled today than it was the day it was written or the day that the ACLU was organized. In the last 10 years, I think the progress has been enormous. It is also true that the progress in the next 10 years is probably not going to be as enormous. But this is a long-distance game, and it's not a game to be won or lost in the space of a short amount of time.
We talked a little bit before about how rights that you win within a precedent, you can lose within a later precedent that's set afterwards. Abortion is perhaps an example of that. The right to abortion was won, and it now seems to be being undermined on both a local and national level. What kind of work is the ACLU doing in terms of abortion rights presently?
Well, a great deal. I think it's fair to say that the ACLU is the legal arm of the abortion rights movement. There are presently about 80 or 90 cases around the country in which somebody has gone into court to try to stop the enforcement of a local or state law restricting the right of a woman to choose an abortion. The ACLU is directly involved in about two-thirds of those cases. And we have three lawyers in the National Office in New York who do nothing else full-time but litigate directly those cases or supervise other lawyers who are litigating them. We have been enormously successful. There is virtually no court in which we have not been able to block those laws and block enforcement of those laws, pending, of course, Supreme Court resolution of those issues. How that will be resolved both politically and legally in the Supreme Court is anybody's guess. But in the last 3 or 4 years, it's fair to say that had the ACLU not been involved in those 50 or 60 cases around the country, effectively a woman's right to choose an abortion would have been stopped in its tracks. It's not easy to say how that's going to end up in the next year or two. But again, it's important to point out where we started. We didn't start that day in 1973 when the Supreme Court said a woman had a right to an abortion. That was the culmination of many, many years of victory. After all, it was only 15 years ago or so, I think it was 1963 or 61 perhaps, where it was still legal for a state to prohibit the selling of contraceptive devices. It was not until the early 60s that the Supreme Court ruled that the state of Connecticut could not do that, and that kind of a law was an unconstitutional invasion of marital privacy, or any other kind of privacy, or non-marital privacy. In a country where it was still okay to ban the sale of contraceptives, where every state in this country made it criminal to perform or to choose an abortion, as recently as the early 70s, you're dealing with an issue again, which in the longer view is an issue which we are winning and which we're going to win. The fact that you're winning an issue doesn't mean that the other side isn't going to have momentary victories, and that's what we're seeing now with the abortion issue. I think the so-called right to lifers represent a very small minority. I think the issue has been unfairly characterized as a Catholic issue, because in fact polls show that most Catholics agree with the right to choose an abortion and disagree with the official doctrine of the Church. So you're dealing with an issue here in which I think it's possible to predict victory, because I think that the people who want to impose their views on others are a small group and will eventually lose. But for the moment, the issue is a difficult one.
The argument that's most frequently used now by right-to-lifers is that to have an abortion is to murder life,
right,
and is to kill a fetus. And there's possibility of a constitutional convention to grant rights of personhood to the fetus. How do you respond to those charges?
Well, I would be more impressed, I suppose, if the right to life is, had enough respect for life to oppose capital punishment also, or to support a lot of welfare bills that provide people with basic needs when they are alive. I mean, you will find in the legislature that the people who oppose abortion because of their supposed sanctity for life also support capital punishment and also regularly oppose aid to the poor. It has often made me think that the only way to make sense of all that is to assume that these are people who support life before birth and after death, but not in between. the fact is that people who are opposed conscientiously to abortion are opposed because they do believe that from the moment of conception, from the first instant of conception, the fertilized egg is in fact the moral equivalent of a full-grown human being. And therefore, to have an abortion is indistinguishable from killing an infant. Now, they believe that, and if you believe that, then abortion is murder, and it ought to be prohibited just like any other murder. The problem is that not everybody believes that, and the belief is basically a question of religious dispute. I don't mean in any formal sense, but it's the kind of question that can't be decided by consensus, it can't be decided by science, and it can't even be decided by religion because all kinds of religions disagree as to what the belief is. It's a classic example of an attempt by people who believe one thing religiously to impose their belief through law on everybody else. The First Amendment was designed to protect us against that kind of thing. It means the reason why you have a separation of church and state is that the Constitution and the First Amendment stands for the principle that people may not enforce their own religious beliefs, no matter how strongly they hold them, upon other people through laws, through civil laws. The attempt to prohibit abortions is an attempt by people who believe that the fetus is a human being to impose that religious belief upon people who do not believe it. That is basically the problem. We support the right of people who hold that belief not to have abortions, that if doctors hold that belief, we don't think they can be compelled to perform abortions, or nurses, or anybody else. But it basically, for us, is not a right to abortion. It's really a right to choose. And that right to choose is based on your right to hold your own belief about what that fertilized ovum is, and not to have that belief dictated to you by other people.
How does the ACLU look now? What kind of shape is it in as an organization?
Well, we have about 200,000 members throughout the country. We have affiliates in every state and in most cities. We have an overall budget over the country of $10 million. We handle about 6,000 cases a year and lobby on hundreds and hundreds of bills. We're a pretty big organization. We're spread pretty thinly, though. That $10 million is spent disproportionately in the places where it's raised, so that places like New York and Chicago and San Francisco and Los Angeles end up spending most of the money. There are 30 states where the ACLU has an annual budget of less than $100,000, and about 25 of those are less than $50,000, which is not enough money to do a job in protecting civil liberties locally, where it has to be protected. So the ACLU is an organization which, if you look at its overall statistics, seems to be thriving and is thriving, but which is still spread far too thinly to do the kind of job we need to do, and which is always functioning on the edge of bankruptcy because an organization like ours doesn't save money. There's always so much more to do than you got the money to do that you're always spending right at the edge. We don't have an endowment or a reserve fund, so unlike Harvard or some other great university, we have really no reserve cushion to fall back on. And at a time of brutal inflation, such as we have now, it can cost us $1 million a year nationally of more income in 1980 than we had in 79 just to stay even. So we're struggling, and I think an organization like ours will probably continue to struggle. But we basically are in good shape, and I think that we have capacity to raise even more money and get more support than we have done thus far, and I'm hopeful that we will in the next few years.
All right, Glasser, before you leave us, I'd love to hear how you became as involved as you are with civil liberties in America.
Well, it was somewhat accidental. My field is mathematics, as I said a while ago. I am not a lawyer, and I suppose where I am is a product of where a lot of us came to be out of the turmoil of the late 60s and the early 70s. I was teaching mathematics at Queens College and Sarah Lawrence College in New York in the early 60s, and finding it, though I loved it, finding it peculiarly unsatisfying as the society was really heating up, as a great many issues were sort of coming out of the woodwork, and it was hard to be involved in any central way when you were teaching calculus and probability. So I began to just look for a way to get more involved. I ended up leaving math and editing a small magazine of public affairs, and quite by accident met somebody on that editorial staff who later went to work for the ACLU and some years later called me and asked me if I was interested in coming to work there. And by that time it was the late 60s, and it sounded like precisely the sort of activist place that it was important to be at that period of time if you were interested in these issues. So with some trepidation that that I was not a lawyer and that the ACLU was a little narrower than my concerns, because it was, I suffered at that time from the same illusion a lot of people do, that it was an organization just for lawyers. So with some trepidation I went. I frankly did not intend to stay for very long. It seemed to me an interesting place to be, and I had hoped maybe to get in more directly into politics at the time. But it's a place that I have stayed now for a dozen years and have found it to be more important than I thought, primarily for the reason I said a moment ago, that I have come to believe that the job of enforcing limits on government power, whether the government power is exercised by liberals or conservatives, is very important, more important than I believed when I started. And here I am. It would have been hard for me to predict 12 years ago that I'd still be here.
Well, I wish you the best. I wish you continued success, and I wish the best to the ACLU. I want to thank you very much for coming to Fresh Air this afternoon.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
I've been speaking with Ira Glasser. He's the executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union. He's in Philadelphia to speak at the annual meeting of the Greater Philadelphia chapter of the ACLU. This meeting's open to the public if you'd like to attend. It begins at 7:30. It's going to be held at the Ethical Society, which is at 1906 South Rittenhouse Square in Philadelphia. So again, the meeting's at 7:30 at the Ethical Society, 1906 South Rittenhouse Square in Philadelphia. This is Fresh Air. You're listening to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. It's 5 minutes to three. I'd just like to remind you that at 4 o'clock this afternoon, we're going to be joining National Public Radio for live coverage of this afternoon's session at the UN Security Council. So again, that will be at 4 o'clock, live from the UN, this afternoon here on WUHY-FM in Philadelphia.